Hello and welcome to the Paradox Podcast. This is called Unscripted. We've come up with a name, Garrett.
Finally.
And Garrett's going to be asking me questions about my teaching on Hebrews chapter 11. I do not know the questions ahead of time, and that's why it's called Unscripted. So, Garrett, where do you want to start with Hebrews chapter 11?
Well, it's been a little over a week since you preached that sermon. So let's begin with maybe a bit of a recap on what you spoke about, and then kind of what some of your major themes are, and we'll go from there.
So it's called The Hall of Faith and Fallacy, and talked about Hebrews chapter 11, which is the most famous passage in all of Hebrews, and it's called by the religious community, the Christian community, it's called The Hall of Faith. And in there, there are all sorts of biblical heroes, essentially, that are listed as kind of people that are held up as the way that this is the way that you live with faith. And so we went through some of them, and while that sounds good on paper, it becomes problematic pretty quickly when you look at some of the lives closely. Specifically, I'll just highlight one, Jephthah, who is lauded for his faith by the author of Hebrews. But when you look at Jephthah's story, it's about how he swore that if God delivered the Ammonites into his hand, he would slaughter whatever came through his doors first in honor of God. So his daughter is the first thing that comes through his doors once he's defeated the Ammonites, and he slaughters his daughter. And he's held up as a hero of faith. We then talked about how that's problematic, obviously. Talked about the Hall of Fame of baseball and how they draw this line at, like, we don't allow cheaters. But when you look closely at who's allowed into the Hall of Fame, there's several cheaters. And then from there, we took the words of Jesus where he talks about how sinners and tax collectors will lead the way into heaven. And how it's fair to believe that Jesus would, in fact, let a different group of people into the Hall of Faith. And it would probably be entirely composed of tax collectors and prostitutes and sinners. And from there, we talked about what faith was, which is faith is the ability to love in the face of suffering.
Nice.
So that's the quick version of it. I think I did that in about 45 seconds. So.
Yeah, it's good work. The Spark Notes version.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's excellent. Yeah, I think, man, I've been really looking forward to, I didn't know if you're going to preach on this text or not. But when I was just Googling some things initially a couple weeks ago about Hebrews, there's like a, where Google will auto-populate what you're going to search. Mm-hmm. And one of the things was Hebrews. I searched Hebrew, the book of Hebrews, and it goes Hebrews 11 sermon titles. So
yeah.
I clicked on it and, I thought it was funny because some of the sermon titles were like the all-stars of faith,
oh, no.
Superheroes of faith, faith that pleases God. How to please God by being like a person of strong faith. Like,
yeah,
pretty much what people typically grow up when we hear this passage. But, you know, obviously it's something drastically different
from, yeah,
from what you've said and at least what sort of conclusions you draw from,
yeah,
from the sermon. But what I wanted to begin with is you define faith in your sermon as something, would you mind saying the definition? I don't want to get it wrong.
Yeah, faith is the ability to trust love in the face of suffering.
Trust love in the face of,
yes,
suffering. Would you call that, like, maybe we'll take a step backwards. What do you see as the impetus for faith in someone's life? Like, why do we need faith? When we talk about this, obviously this is a huge,
yeah,
thing, and some people think faith and belief synonymous. But let's maybe take a step back and talk about, why do we as humans need faith, and especially in this relationship with God?
Yeah. So there is a natural human reaction to things, right? So for instance, when somebody attacks me, I'm going to have a very, you know, I'm going to have all sorts of physical reactions as far as adrenaline will start pumping and I'll start to look at being defensive. And I would probably, my natural default reaction would be to punch back if somebody punches me, right? And the fact is we live lives where we are attacked both by people as well as the environment, as well as situations. And we have this natural default reaction, which is one of fear or to inflict pain back or to be vindictive towards something that has hurt us.
Mm-hmm.
Faith is a life that is above or a calling beyond what our natural human reactions are. And so faith is an acknowledgement that these things happen, that bad things do happen. And faith is a challenge and an inspiration to live beyond those natural reactions and to trust that if you were to be a person of faith, it is essentially to trust love mm-hmm. when you are attacked or something is taken from you and believe that that is actually the way to go and that justice will be served if you trust love rather than you feel like you have to take on justice yourself.
Gotcha.
So can we talk about Batman?
Would that be all right? Let's do it, man.
So if we talked about Batman, the story of Batman is the idea that the police are corrupt and the justice system is corrupt mm-hmm. and the economic system is corrupt in Gotham City, right? Batman then takes all of that into his own hands and does vindictive vigilante justice
right.
Against people because it doesn't trust it.
Like martial law.
Yes. And yeah. while we love Batman, and Batman I would probably say is my favorite superhero, it is definitely not a life of faith because right. he's not trusting love or trusting anything else to fix the process. He's only trusting his own fists, essentially.
Gotcha.
To heal the process.
Yeah.
So Batman is an antithesis to a life of faith.
Got it. Okay. So working with that definition, trusting in love in the face of suffering, what would you say to somebody who says, well, faith is simply just is simply ignorance, or faith is mm-hmm. trusting in something that you can't see? Faith essentially is the ideological belief that's been protected by societal and religious norms to populate a belief of something more. When in reality, you know, it's nothing more than a belief in fairy tales, or it's nothing more than just me reinforcing my own belief systems with this idea of what would you say? What would you say to that?
It's impossible to separate faith from suffering.
Hmm.
And usually when you have faith absent of suffering, it becomes really annoying really quickly. I call this the Christian radio effect, nice. Which is, you turn on Christian radio and they will tell you very quickly that they are all about being positive and encouraging.
Positive FM, man.
Yeah, you know, they're not even trying to hide it, right?
Right,
and,
right.
You know, at least they're honest about it.
Yeah.
And the idea is we don't deal with suffering here. Like, we don't have to go into those complex topics. We don't have to deal with them because everything's fine. Everything happens for a reason. Right. It will all work out in the end if you just have enough faith.
Yep.
That's not really the human experience.
Hmm.
And there's a point to that. Like, and I think that that's really a good high school faith, is to believe that things will be good regardless of if you suffered or not.
Yeah.
But once you get out of high school, at some point you will encounter some sort of unanswerable suffering.
Mm-hmm.
And when you hear somebody talk about trusting love in the face of that, and they share their testimony, and let's take something tragic like when somebody has to bury their own child.
Yeah.
Man, when they talk about how they're trusting love in the midst of that,
mm-hmm.
In the midst of that horrific suffering, that's a testimony that speaks.
Totally.
And usually it's annoying or superficial if they haven't gone through suffering.
Right.
There's a story of a friend of mine who went through just this horrible thing where his wife died suddenly. And it just left all of us looking for answers because his wife was healthy. She was active. She was fit. And then she just suddenly died one night. And we woke up to text messages saying that our friend's wife had passed away.
Hmm.
You can understand if he'd be bitter and closed off and angry for the rest of his life.
Yeah.
But just a few months ago, this friend got remarried, and the fact that he's willing to trust that it's worthwhile to open himself again and mm-hmm. possibly put himself right. through that situation again, I think is a life of immense faith. And there's nothing superficial about that. That's
Absolutely.
Not him being naive. It's the exact opposite. I mean, he's going into this thing with his eyes wide open, knowing he could be hurt just as badly as again. And for me, that's just a real powerful testament of faith.
Yeah, I really like that. A faith, idea of faith is something that embraces suffering and embraces pain, because I think the irony of all of these sermon titles and just people's mostly understanding of Hebrews 11 is that faith is at its best when it's at its strongest. And it's like just this blind-hearted, go lucky, everything's good. Like, if I have great faith, God's on my side. Mm-hmm. When I, in my experience, the times I have been most moved by someone's faith is when it's at its most meek point. Like it's the most humble offering of, I hope this is where God is leading me. But it's like you said, it's somebody who is willing to, in the face of immense pain and agony and suffering, trust that there's something more.
Mm-hmm.
That's when those are the stories that get me.
Well, and faith is often misunderstood as just believing unscientific things.
Right. Exactly.
Which is, so, for, I mean, we're in this season. So the virgin birth.
Right.
Right. Yeah, there's a lot of people that would hold a virgin birth up to a Christian and use it as a marker of who's in and who's out, who has enough faith to believe an unscientific fact. But that's not really the faith that I see in the life of Jesus. Instead, the faith of Jesus would say, okay, you believe the virgin birth. That's fine. You know, I support that. There's nothing wrong with believing that. But I believe Jesus would then say, so how does that change you?
Yeah.
And if there's no answer for that other than, well, I know that, so I don't, so I can ignore more science. Like, if there's no answer for it, it's like, well, what's the point then? Who cares if you believe in it, if it doesn't change you or transform you?
Yeah. Good point. Do you think faith is a feeling?
No.
No.
Mm-mm. No, I think it's, I think it takes courage. I think it's transformative. I don't think you can just feel faithful. I think it actually demands change and transformation from an individual that, that trusts faith. I think faith, I use trust there to describe faith. Faith is ultimately trust. And it shapes and motivates and inspires change within an individual as it trusts a message or it trusts another human being going forward. And that's once again when I find faith to be the most powerful.
Yeah. Do you think atheists have faith?
Yes. Once again though, this is a conundrum with what the word faith means.
Right, exactly.
If people think it means to believe unscientific things, then they're going to end up in a world of problems. Atheists that practice faith are once again the people who trust love in the face of suffering. And that takes real faith. There's a novel called A Time to Kill by John Grisham.
Yeah. And
have you read it?
Yeah, I have. It's beautiful.
So in there, there's this idea that a man does not trust the justice system. He's a black man who does not trust the justice system to convict someone who has killed his daughter. Because after all, when you look at American history, it has been without a doubt slanted against African-American men and women throughout the history of this nation. So he ends up killing the man in a courtroom that's convicted or that's on trial for killing his daughter. That's a bit of a tricky situation because, you know, there's a reason to not trust the justice system.
Totally.
From a racial perspective. But at the same time, it's not a life of faith necessarily. It is the idea that we have to change things on our own. And it's not like passive, like, oh, I got hands off. As much as there's this sense that justice will prevail if because of the goodness of people. And there's times that you have to rally against that, and faith requires you to rally against it. And there's other times that you have to trust that people will make the right decision coming through. So, yes, I think atheists can practice that in the midst of immense suffering, regardless of what their background is.
Gotcha. Yeah, I like that because, I don't know, it bugs me sometimes when faith is defined as something that is, like you're saying, a denial of reality or a denial of science or but I think even trusting in science is true is a form of faith. Like that's it's some people may believe in a different reality, but I think every human being has some sort of faith. Do you think there's a difference between like you're using trust and faith synonymously? Do you think there's a difference between trust or faith and belief?
Yeah, well, they're just so interwoven, it's hard to distinguish between them, right?
Yeah.
So, for instance, if I believe that God is good, I'm going to have faith that changes the way I am as I believe, as I live that out, right?
Right, right.
For instance, my friend Tyler, who's agnostic, he and I have a lot of faith that humanity can do something to take care of the planet better.
Yeah.
Now we have different beliefs that motivate those things.
Yeah, exactly.
But both of those beliefs motivate the faith that, well, we can drive cars that require less gas. And so we both drive cars that are fuel efficient. And we have different we have different reasons for that belief and the origin within us.
Right.
But ultimately it's both faith that we say like, okay, well, we can do this. You know, a lot of people write off agnostics or atheists because they say, well, they believe in survival of the fittest and therefore, you know, they're not people of God and they can't really be people of faith. But what I found is that most agnostics and atheists I know care more about the environment than Christians. And they're dedicated to trying and preserving this planet with a zeal that is greater than Christians, because they sense that this planet's all they've got. And so therefore they better do whatever they can to take care of it and to give their children something that can take care of this planet as well. All right. So Garrett, I've got a question for you.
I'm ready.
Tell me about high school faith and how that's different than adult faith, because you spent several years as a youth pastor.
Yep.
And I'm curious what you would say to this, because I noticed a pretty sharp difference, but I'm curious what your thoughts were on that.
Yeah. I'm trying to think of an effective analogy for this, but I'll use my taste in music, for example. So in high school, I liked a lot of like pop punk bands, which when you really look into their like lyrics are about pretty much nothing. But it's a catchy tune. There's not much substance to the music.
Yeah.
You can tell that the music itself was not formed by any sort of profound life experience or anything like that, but it's fun. It's a very shallow, it's like pop music in general, very shallow, easy to listen to, catchy songs. Now I like bands very, very different than, like, I like bands mostly because of how the music moves me, and it's not necessarily on a musical level, though that's important, but it's from a lyrical standpoint. I'll use the artist, for example, like Bon Iver.
Mm-hmm.
I think his album for Emma Forever Ago is one of the most
so good,
unbelievably moving albums ever written. And it's because, you know, he was engaged at the time. Either he was dating somebody, or I believe he was engaged and had his heart just ripped out of his chest, went up to a cabin and wrote a whole set of songs just based out of that raw emotion. And you can feel it in his songs. You can feel it in all of them. And so I would say faith, in the difference between a high school type of faith and an adult type of faith, is I don't know if you're ready at a high school age to embrace the spectrum of emotions that are necessary for a mature type of faith. And that's not a bad thing, right? There needs to be, I think it's, is it Reza Aslan?
Mm-hmm.
Is that his first name?
Yeah.
The author of Zealot talks about how in his belief system, religion is important, but to a certain point. Not saying that this is where we're going, but essentially you get to the point where you're able to transcend those sorts of fundamental beliefs and the ideas that you grew up with understanding as absolute truths. As you get older, you start to understand that there's something more, there's something bigger, but those beliefs served a purpose. And so your high school faith serves a tremendous purpose.
Yeah.
And I would say my high school faith, I'll speak from personally, served the purpose as, God is good. You go to heaven if you do A, B, and C. And these are the people who are in, these are the people who are out. These are the things that you need to do to be a good person. Like, I had a very clear cut ethical and moral guidelines based on my religion. But as I think I've gotten older and as I've understood more of the teachings of Jesus, Jesus continually tried to not necessarily contradict morality, but push us beyond our understanding of who we assume is in and who we assume is out.
Mm-hmm.
And I would hope that my faith has matured since being in high school. But yeah, I would definitely say my faith was simpler as well in high school. It was much, if someone were to ask me what it means to have faith, I'd probably have a much clearer definition.
Yeah.
As today, but all the more, faith is just as meaningful.
Yeah.
How about for you?
Well, I liked your analogy of the pop punk thing, because I went to see Blink 182 with Peter Fukuda.
Uh-huh.
And they played Dumpweed.
Yeah, one of their first songs.
Off of Enema of the State.
Yeah.
And wait, was it Dumpweed? No, it's the Weasel song. Got a lot of heartache.
Oh, yeah. What's
that song called? Dysentery Gary.
Yeah.
That's it.
Dysentery Gary.
Dysentery Gary. So it wasn't Dumpweed. Dysentery Gary. And it's off an album called Enema of the State, for crying out loud.
Yeah.
So you can kind of guess where it goes. But the chorus, the big hook is the line, girls are such a drag.
Yeah.
And here I was, I think I was 32 at the time we went to the concert. And I know every word because this was like my whole high school experience was in a Blink 182.
Same.
And I remember screaming, "Girls are such a drag." And then I remember I had this moment where I'm like, "Are they? Because I love my daughter. And I love my wife. They're not a drag.
Right.
They're great. Right. I love them to death." Like, but when I was 16 or whatever, it was perfect because, you know, there's so much, you know, opposition and tension between the sexes or whatever.
Totally.
And it's just what I knew, and that really spoke to me. And now it's like that just doesn't work anymore.
Right. Exactly.
So what, like when I was a youth pastor, I remember just being like, if I can get them to believe that they're worthwhile, mm-hmm. and they're valuable in the eyes of God.
Yep.
And not at the expense of someone else.
Yes.
I will
yes.
have feel like I will have felt like I've done my job at the end yep. of 4 years
yep.
as a youth pastor. And you couldn't really go into complexity because there were parents at home that were really hoping that you would teach them one way on the complex issues.
Totally.
So you had to kind of jump around that a lot.
Yep.
And that's not to knock the religious system or anything like that as much as I really wanted them to, I felt like I was in a good place as their youth pastor. If they
right.
left feeling like they were valuable in the eyes of God and they weren't more valuable than someone else in the eyes of God.
Yeah.
Like those were the two things I tried my best to,
those are good
to do.
My, like measures of success as a youth pastor, my thing I tried to do so often in a lot of sermons too, and just like different programs we tried to begin and do different things were the idea of that the skills and the talents you have matter,
mm-hmm.
and they matter not only to God, but they matter to the world,
mm-hmm.
and you have something to offer. And that was my thing. I was like, man, if kids could just understand
yeah.
that. You have a unique thing that no one else can offer, and creating a platform where kids can unleash that was really important to me. But I'm with you, man. I mean, I had so many times where kids ask you really tough questions straight up and you can't give
yeah.
an honest answer.
Well, and to give people an idea, like I had a dad whose whole barometer for success for my youth ministry was whether or not his son had sex before marriage.
Yeah.
And like if he had sex before marriage, it was my fault somehow.
Dude, youth pastors are the religious birth control for a lot of parents.
It's so
man.
Weird.
It is weird.
It's so weird. And that's kind of what you're working with and what
yep.
you're dealt. And I, once again, this isn't a critique of the religious system as much as that was the step forward I was trying to get people.
Yeah.
And when you say like, yeah, trying to get them to recognize that their gifts and the work that they did was valuable, that is a step forward considering where most people start with faith.
Definitely. Yeah, I agree. My favorite moments as a youth pastor, I shouldn't say that this is sarcastically, but when I have a parent who you could tell they've been arguing with their kid over some sort yeah. of issue. And they would come up to me and like on Saturday morning and they would say, "Pastor Garrett, don't you think that the 144,000 in the book of Revelation are only Adventists?" And their kid's right there and I'm right there and they pitch the question like that. You're like, how on earth do you answer this? Like, they just need a pastoral justification that
yeah.
they're right. And, but man, no, I it was one of the hardest things for me to know how to answer those tough questions with high school students, because you can't just shotgun their faith. And because they're in such a different place developmentally, and you have to think back too, to even though you want to give them the answer, you want to give them an honest answer. You can't, because you forget of all the steps you mm-hmm. went through to get to the place where you're at.
Yeah.
And they're not even close to there. And to give them that answer oftentimes is really unhelpful, because they're like, they just go to the place of, well, Pastor Garrett thinks that and he's a pastor, so I believe that too, which mm-hmm. is, you know,
yeah,
completely opposite of what we're trying to accomplish as yeah. youth pastors.
Well, and it was a big moment where I switched to college ministry, and I had a mother come up to me after I started talking about the complex issues, because you really have to start talking about the complex issues in college. Otherwise,
definitely
nobody shows up.
Right.
And that's been my understanding of the way that college ministry works. And you start talking about those more difficult issues. And there was a mom that came up to me after one of my sermons when I'd spoken on how gay people were children of God too. Nothing about same-sex marriage, nothing about any of that, about how we need to advocate or accept them or put them in leadership positions, nothing like that. Just simply that we as a church need to recognize that gay people are children of God too. And this mother came up to me just furious, and she had this son in tow, and the son was just disengaged. You could just tell, right? Which is fine. I don't need him to be engaged.
Right.
But she came up and she said to me, he's like, my son is here and he's 23 years old. And I said, okay. And she said, I think he's going to leave here not sure what Christianity is. So I need you to tell him that being gay is a sin. And I just looked at her and I said, I think you need to let your son make his own choices at 23. And yada, yada, yada. A few years later, I'm not working there anymore. But I, at 23, it's like, you got to recognize that you got to let him hear something that you may disagree with, that he may disagree with, and be okay with it.
Totally.
Because if you need somebody to say all the things that you can agree with, it's impossible to find that person as a pastor.
Right.
One. Two, if you feel like the church does say things that you can all agree with, then it's just so obnoxiously vague that they're not actually saying anything.
Yeah. Yeah, that's an amazing story.
It was a pretty awesome moment in my pastoral career.
I've actually never heard that story before. That's good. Oh, man. Yeah,
23, man. 23.
Crazy. That blows my mind. I was just thinking while you're telling that story, I hope I never, ever get to that place as a parent. 23 years old.
Well, and I have to accept that Maya and Bodhi, my kids, will have a Christianity that will bring them to places that I'm uncomfortable with.
Yeah.
And I'm okay with, I have to be okay with that now.
Totally.
Thinking ahead and anticipating that. Because if I don't, then I'm essentially not allowing them to own their Christian faith.
Right. Exactly. You're stunting the whole process of faith and growth. And I think it's interesting that too, that this lady had such a, like, that you could sum up homosexuality as a sin in a quick sentence. Like, to me, that's such a, it's so disingenuous of people. Like,
yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Like, oh yeah, that's a sin. What? But they're also children of God. It's just, it's silly.
Well, and what I found about talking about the LGBT community to people of faith, to use that word.
Yeah.
Is that you could say nice things about them, as long as it was predicated or framed in a conversation where you said not nice things about them, you know?
Yeah, but they're not going to heaven.
So as long as you say stuff like, hey, we should be nice to gay people, but remember that if you're gay, that's totally a sin and you're terrible in the eyes of God. People were like, yeah, we should be nicer to them.
Yeah.
Like, they're totally fine with it.
Yeah.
And it's only if you were able to undercut, and we're talking about, you know, people's sexuality, very intimate feelings.
Yes, people and, as humans.
Yeah, and very much the fibers of their being.
Yep.
As long as you undercut that, then you can be nice to them. Jeez. Which I think is a really, really interesting ignorance of who Jesus Christ actually was.
Yep. Yeah, you know, recently, I don't know if you saw this, but did you see the letter that was sent out by... Northern California Conference?
I did.
Have we talked about this?
I don't know. I we haven't.
I know we haven't talked about it on the podcast, but I didn't know if you and I had talked about
it. No, we haven't talked about it.
I thought.
Can you explain it so that people know?
Yeah, let's do it. Let's add some context. So a letter was sent out recently after, I don't even know, this is in the Adventist church for people who are wondering, after, I think it's called the annual council that we had for the general conference. And this letter was sent out after, I believe, that the annual council. And at the annual council, primarily the issue of women's ordination was discussed. Now, the reason why some people postulate the issue of women's ordination is such a linchpin issue in the Adventist church is because of the issue of homosexuality.
I disagree with that 100%, by the way.
it's the most ridiculous argument
and
ever.
Just real quick, let me jump in here and tell you why I disagree. I just think that men that are in charge of church leadership are sexist.
Exactly.
And so
no, totally.
They don't want to say they're sexist, so they're saying we're defending against
homosexuality.
Yeah. So they're
it's
like
a slippery slope.
They're homophobic and they're
and
sexist.
They're sexist, yes.
But let's be very clear.
Oh, I could not agree with you more.
To say that women cannot be ordained, which is the highest honor a church can place on a minister.
Right.
Legally, and that's recognized by the state.
Yes.
To say that women cannot be ordained is a sexist thing.
Yes.
Period. And so, anyways, clearly. I just have to jump in there because...
Especially when we require women to get the exact same amount of education as a man.
Yes.
And to serve in the same capacity, yep. the same degree, and to get to the end point and saying, yeah, but you'll never be equal to a man.
Yeah.
We're going to take all your money, we're going to take all your years of service, and you're never going to get there.
And the crazy part, Garrett, is that they're sitting there in a country who has deemed through 7 or 8 decades of terrible Jim Crow laws. They're sitting in this country.
Yes.
And saying like, well, it's separate but equal. It's totally fine. And they completely ignore American history. Like, have no context whatsoever that separate but equal is never equal.
Yes. And furthermore, ordination biblically is a call to deeper, more profound service.
Yes.
The Adventist Church has made it like this sort of like hoity-toity, like add another star to your crown, which biblically there's like really no sort of biblical foundation to ordination as we practice it today as Adventists. Furthermore, yes. it's a call to deeper service, deeper humility. Why are we withholding that from people? It's unbelievable. Anyways, so some people within the Adventist Church view this issue as it's a slippery slope. And once we ordain women, the next thing a homosexual is going to be a Sabbath school teacher. Like, what is going to happen then? Surely the Lord will come. And anyway,
which, by the way, sorry, one more time, I got to jump in here.
Please.
Was also the argument the American government used against allowing women the right to vote, because if we allowed women the right to vote, it was a slippery slope to letting black people have the right to vote.
I had no
this
idea.
Is well documented throughout American history. And may I remind you, sorry, I'm getting worked up.
We're still using the same argument.
I'm fired up right now.
Good, man. Go for it.
May I remind you, the headquarters are in the United States of America, and it's just completely ignorant of American history because it's outside of the church, so therefore it doesn't matter. And yet you have this overwhelming evidence that this should not take place and is completely corrupt and unjust and despicable.
Yeah.
Thank you for listening.
No, that's... Amen, brother. There's so many things about this whole situation that bother me. And the annual council to me was, I couldn't even watch it. I watched like 30 minutes. Like, I have to turn this off. I was getting viscerally angry just watching it. So anyways, this letter comes out from, I believe it was from Northern California Conference, and it cited a pastor. I don't think it cited him by name, but it's not too hard to look up who it was. Pastor from Chico Seventh-day Adventist Church who had, didn't exactly say what he had done, but essentially he had offered extended membership to...
I believe he baptized.
Oh, he did baptize?
I believe
okay.
he baptized a lesbian couple in a public relationship.
Yeah, gotcha. So he was cited punitively in this letter that was sent out to, mind you, I imagine every church or every pastor, or I don't know exactly how that works.
I don't know that. I think it was just the Northern California Conference.
Okay.
Which is anywhere north of Fresno, I believe.
I think so.
And all the way up to the northern border of California.
Right.
So
it's sent out to at least the members mm-hmm. or the constituents of the Northern California Conference. And it cited, it bothered me so much. It cited... It was exactly like what you just said of like, we need to extend, we need to be welcoming, we need to be nice, but just remember there will be measures taken or disciplinary actions taken for any pastor who gains or who offers extends church membership to someone practicing homosexuality. Like the wording of it was so, so bad. I was like, okay, first of all, The first thing that bothered me about it is that we're like giving pastors spankings for being welcoming into the church, because I mean, clearly that's not the church's place. Number two, what bothered me about it is the church's still antiquated understanding of homosexuality. Like, this isn't something that people just choose when they wake up.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't personally believe it is. I don't think someone wakes up and they're like, hey, I'm just going to open myself up to a way harder life. Do you know what I mean? Like, especially in today's society, especially if somebody who is religious in the Adventist church, like that is, I don't still think people are going to choose that.
See, and that's like a really warped and poor understanding of what it means to be bisexual.
Yeah.
Whatever it is that you just described is how the church feels. Exactly. And they'll say stuff like, well, it's a choice. So just choose
not to
choose the norm.
Exactly.
Which is a terrible way to describe it.
Right.
But it's like, it's a really poor understanding of what bisexuality is. And even when I've spoken to bisexuals, they've said like, it's not just like a choice.
It's not an on-off switch. Yeah. Exactly.
It's just, you're attracted to this person and you get this sense that if you don't express that attraction towards someone, it will eat away at you inside.
Hmm.
And you hear that kind of testimony and you're like, oh, I may have this all wrong.
Yeah.
And you could go through my history as a Christian in high school and have all that faith, right? And I could tell you when I was 18, I would say, like, you know, people that are homosexual are wrong. And, you know, they're going to hell, but, you know, that's just the way life is, all that stuff, right?
Yep.
And you could watch this, you could track me essentially and understand that there's been this growing awareness of how fraught that understanding of LGBT issues was and is. And it's stuff I'm not proud of, and yet stuff that I have to acknowledge is part of my history.
Yep. I think that's the power too, going back to the text of Hebrews 11, is it's this proclamation, at least by the text that we use of Jesus, of the people who have been abused by power are going to be the first into the kingdom of God. Mm-hmm. And I think in this context, today in our history, in religious history, the people who have just been beat down by the power structures are homosexuals. I mean, unbelievably so.
Well, and I've heard that comment that prostitutes and tax collectors will lead the way into heaven.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard it 1,000 times.
Me too.
From religious leaders, right? What I've never heard is the context of where that conversation took place.
Yeah.
And when you're like, oh, Jesus was speaking to the religious people who had kicked those people out,
right?
You're like, oh, this story becomes something else. And you were there, right, when I gave this sermon?
Yep.
There was somebody, I don't know who it was, but I said, like, and Jesus says these words that prostitutes and tax collectors will lead the way into heaven. And somebody said, oh, like it was a really audible.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Like that is, and I don't know who that person was, but they got it right away of like, oh, Jesus is not being kind here.
Yeah.
Jesus is giving a scathing critique of the religious institution and who they've kicked out and what they're going to have to endure as heaven continues to challenge and confront corrupt system of power.
Absolutely. Yeah. Oh, man. It's good, man. It's good. Anything else you want to talk about from Hebrews? Imagine there's so much stuff that you read and thought. And
It was a tough book to write sermons from.
Was it?
Because I think we talked about this earlier, but the context, there's just not a lot.
Right.
It's real. I mean, you know, he's writing to a Jewish audience, and you know that he's speaking to people shortly after the resurrection of Christ.
Uh-huh.
But man, like other than that, you don't know much.
Yep.
And so you kind of have to put a bunch of pieces together. That being said, I think the themes that he hits are incredibly valuable for 2017.
Hmm.
Not my favorite stylistic choices in the way that he presents it.
Right.
But when you get to what he's actually saying, and I'm sure for the time that it was written, it's quite profound.
Ah, that's good.
So
it's really good. I love the fact that he includes Rahab.
Yeah.
Into the list of for the Hall of Faith or.
Yeah. And why do you love that?
I love that they included Rahab because I think the author is up to something in including her in the narrative. And to me, I know we love to talk about this idea, but I think in almost every biblical story, there's a step forward. And I think the fact that he's including a female for one in the Hall of Faith, as we like to think of it, it's not all men. I think that's great. And then furthermore, the idea of her being a prostitute, I think is brilliant. So,
yeah. And I think that he's kind of got a glimmer of what Jesus was teaching.
Mm-hmm.
And I know me, once you kind of get those glimmers,
yep,
it's hard to commit fully to them, especially with your tradition and where you've come from. So I think he caught on to something, although it's not as far as Jesus would have pushed him. And this is why I had that line in the teaching where it's like, it's fair to believe that Jesus would have written a completely different Hall of Faith than the author of Hebrews.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Is there a moment, like, is there a favorite moment that stuck out for you in reading through this book, or an idea or central theme that kind of you came away of like, I never knew that before?
I think so Hebrews was interesting because I had to read it about 19 seems low to me right now. Yeah. I feel like it was over 30 times.
Wow.
Because it was just always like the language is so lofty.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not going to lie, it's not really enjoyable to read. Mm-hmm. It's not my favorite book of the Bible.
Yeah, mine either.
That being said, I feel like after all of those times, I came away with this author was trying to explain what faith was.
Mm.
And the high priest, I mean, that takes a tremendous amount of faith. And that's the central argument mm-hmm. of this document. The way that he introduces the topic with Jesus being the Son of God requires mm-hmm. faith and how that changes. And the thing that I grew to appreciate this letter that, once again, is not admittedly my favorite, is how this person would often use these lofty ideals of what faith was and then do his best to explain what that looked like in real life. And it's hard to find those when you read it. So if you read through Hebrews and you're saying to yourself, you know, I don't see that. I don't see it on the first time. I'll tell you, I get it because it took me multiple readings over and over again for me to finally feel like I was comfortable with what he was saying. Ironically, I've taken two classes on Hebrews in my life, and I feel like I was starting from scratch when I got there again because it's a tough book. It's a short, tough book, which makes it bearable, but it's a tougher book. The one teaching I cut out was the one on Melchizedek.
Mm, okay.
And Rob Bell writes about this in the book, What is the Bible? And his chapter on that is fantastic.
Because, really?
Well, Melchizedek shows up and is a prominent character. And in the book of Hebrews, it says that Jesus is of the order of Melchizedek. And the way that Rob Bell talks about it in his book, What is the Bible? Is that Melchizedek was outside of the system and that God continually uses things that are beyond the scope of what a religion can offer. And so when Jesus showed up and talked about living among people and loving others, that was so far outside the religious system. And what Rob Bell is saying is that the author is drawing a parallel between Jesus being outside of the religious establishment and showing God that's bigger than the religion. And it's quite profound. Nice. And powerful. So that was sermon number 5. If I would have had one more week.
Cool.
I cut it though because I'm like, well, Rob Bell pretty much taught it better than I ever could. Yeah, yeah. So why try?
Yeah.
So I highly recommend that book, and that chapter is one of the best chapters in that book.
That's good. I'll have to check that out.
Yeah.
Excellent, man. Do you any other things you wanted to share about the book or ideas?
No, I think that's about it. I felt good about the length of the series. And one thing I really appreciated was you being part of this and doing this. This really made me think about the teaching, and you really made me think about what I was going to say because I knew you were going to call me on a couple days later, which is a new format.
Yep.
And these conversations have inspired this unscripted event that's coming up in December 30.
Yeah, let's talk about that for a little bit.
Yeah, so Kelly Phipps, who's an elder at the church, is going to interview me with questions that people submit. You can submit questions to sermons@paradoxministry.org, and we're looking back at the whole year.
Any sermon.
And
any question, any topic. You're a brave man.
Well, I'm excited to see if it works. I've built up enough equity with the boards at Paradox that if it just totally flops, we'll be okay. We'll move on.
Totally. I think it's going to be fun.
But this format, I've gotten a lot of positive feedback from people, and I'd love to do it live, and especially to look back and say any sermon at any point this year can be brought up, and you can bring any question forward, whether you're an online listener or you're an attendee. I think it's going to be a lot of fun. Now, I think what's going to really make it good is if people ask specific questions about specific teachings.
Yes.
So if you were to say like, hey, and you're teaching the biblical definition of marriage, which was all the way back in January, I really had a problem with the way that you portrayed women, specifically this part. Like that specific question is going to give it a lot of energy.
Totally.
So yeah, if there's one that you thought to yourself, you know, I really didn't like that teaching, go back and listen to it and come up with a question that kind of embodies that, because I think it'll make it really good. And then we'll record it and put it on the podcast.
And I think we should tell the listeners too, that anytime they have a question, we're willing to answer questions too, on this podcast, on our weekly podcast. If they had a question, jot it, throw it in your phone, you know, write it down or whatever you need to do, and send it over to sermons@paradoxministry.org.
That's it.
And we'll talk about it on the unscripted podcast.
Yeah, and so we'll see how this goes live. I'm excited. I've thought about how to respond to these things when I don't know the questions, and this was Garrett's idea to do all these questions unscripted, which I think is what people have liked about this podcast. So we'll see how it goes in front of a group of people.
Yep.
I've always said the thing that's interesting about ministry is when you make mistakes, you make it in front of a group of people.
Totally. Fall flat on your face. Yeah,
which is the challenge of the job.
Yep, yep.
But it's also where the exciting part comes in. So.
Absolutely. What are you most excited about for this next year?
So we're doing 9 books.
Okay.
We did 5 this year, which was way below our average. But when you do Leviticus and Matthew,
you gotta
take some time.
Totally.
So we're going back to a little bit more of a rapid pace to go through more books. So I'm excited about that. We're doing Romans and Joshua, which probably has the worst theology in all the Bible.
I was going to say Joshua will be fun. I can't wait to do this podcast for Joshua.
We're doing Lamentations, which is one I wanted to do for a while.
Nice.
So it's going to be really good. 1 and 2 Thessalonians are on the docket for next year.
Okay.
So 9 books. So I'm excited to get back to more, to closer to a ratio of 1 book at a time, 1 month at a time.
Perfect.
And that should be a lot of fun to get back to that. And if there's topics that you ever feel like need to be discussed, we, before every sermon series starts, we invite the congregation of Paradox to read through ahead of time. And then we're going to have these Friday night gatherings before the series starts. And people can ask questions. They can talk about topics they want to be brought up during the book that we're reading. And that'll happen before every sermon series. And we'd love for people to be part of that. So
awesome.
The whole goal is to get it so that, you know, it's not just me talking.
Right.
It's a community exploring and wrestling and understanding. And whenever I speak, like a lot of people, especially religious people, are brought up with the idea that when the pastor says something, it's the final word.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how we want things to go at Paradox. Right. We want this to be a place where it starts the conversation, not ends it.
So. Absolutely. And I think that's the beauty of this podcast, too, is that if people have a question but don't really feel comfortable asking you in person, or often maybe don't have the chance, maybe they listen from their house or on the podcast after the fact, they weren't able to be there on Saturday, can just submit a question and we'll give voice to that. And it continues the conversation and continues this journey of our community wrestling with different topics.
And it can be anonymous. Just say, I'd like to withhold my name.
Yeah,
when
totally.
You guys ask the question, that's totally fine. So we're just really committed to that. One other thing that's another part of it is that we write 3 discussion questions every week and put it at paradoxquestions.org.
Okay. Because
we want you guys to move from rows to circles.
Nice.
So that way you can talk and wrestle with the text as well. Because once again, it's not meant to end discussion. It's meant to start discussion.
Beautiful.
So, yeah.
And there's one more thing. I mean, we got a little concert coming up.
We do. So that's on Saturday night, December 16, Christmas music on State Street.
It's going to
be a great time. Bring a jacket, bring a lawn chair, bring a friend. Have a great time. So it'll be outdoors, downtown Redlands at 7:00, December 16.
Awesome. Thanks, man.
Hey, thank you, Garrett. I really appreciate the thoughtfulness you put in the questions and this idea that you came up with about asking unscripted questions. So thank you so much for that. And thanks for listening.